session. Everyone's had their second cup of coffee and their croissant or their biscuits, and are now fully awake for this, what will be certainly be a fascinating and enjoyable session. In the 1970s, there were two banes for record collectors in the 1970s. Well, one bane for record collectors and one bane for music lovers. The bane for record collectors was vinyl, and the bane for music lovers was disco. But two of the good things that happened in the 70s were the creation of the telecable in 1977 and the inauguration of the New World Records collection in 1976. We're going to begin now with Telarc. Telarc is a label that I'm sure everyone knows about. Telarc is one of the glories of the American record business, and it's also one of the glories of private industry because it is private. They began in 77 and have continued until this day, creating a tremendous catalog of classical music, pop music, show music, in using technology that is always state-of-the-art. Because we're always running short of time for the sessions, I'd like to ask the founders of Telarc, Mr. Robert Woods and Mr. Jack Renner, to come forward and tell their story about how that record label was created. Please welcome Jack and Bob.
That's your water? Well, I'll move your water over here. That's what partnerships are all about, being able to accommodate differences.
Now, if I wanted to drive the sound engineer nuts, I would blow into the microphone and ask if it was on. We could tell stories for the rest of the day and the rest of the week, but we'll try to condense 26 years, 27 years of work into a short time here this morning. Why did Telarc all come about? How have we managed to stay afloat during what is certainly one of the most interesting and puzzling times in the history of the record business? Bob and I got together in the early 70s. I was doing what I kind of don't like the term, but I was doing souvenir recordings, which is to say I was driving a van filled with recording gear around to various school, church, high school, auditorium, and making souvenir recordings of the performances. But one of the last things I did before this business collapsed in the early 70s was to record the entire march output of John Philip Sousa with Leonard Smith and the Detroit Concert Band. So it was not all just souvenir and, you know, memorabilia kind of things. But it became pretty obvious by the mid-70s that, you know, the souvenir business was not going to keep food on my table for very much longer. There were a couple reasons for that. One was the invention of the cassette, where mom and dad could come to every concert that their children performed in and record every single note they played. And, you know, the kids had everything they wanted, and when the music director would say, well, gee, it's time to make another record, the kids would say, a record? We made a record last year. And in the early 70s, that was the beginning of the time of what we like to call instant gratification. You know, we made a record last year. That's no big deal anymore. Let's do something that's more exciting and interesting and whatever. So Bob and I needed a way to further our careers. We both have degrees in music education, performance, call it what you will. We both have teaching in our backgrounds. So we thought that there might be a way to continue what we were doing, to combine the recording and entrepreneurial skills that we had been developing over the few years in the early 70s and turn it into something that might attract a little more attention and a little more income. Bob had some contacts in the industry. He's a vocalist. He had some contacts from his experience and from places he was living. So in the early 70s, I decided on my own that I was going to form a commercial label, which is to say that you actually hire people. You have to be a signatory to the AFM. You hire union musicians. And at that time, it was becoming very popular for professional musicians to do vanity records. Principal players in the Cleveland Orchestra, for instance, while their talents were good enough to get them, you know, for people to want to hear what they could do on record, the major record companies, you know, just wouldn't touch them. So they would come to somebody like us and say, I will pay for my record, you know, will you do it? Yes, well, we did. It worked out fine. It gave us experience. It gave us contacts. The drawback was is that, you know, you're afraid that at any point in any day, one of these players is going to call, and one of them did, and say, my grandmother cannot find my records in Keokuk, Iowa, in the record store. Why not? Well, I won't go into why not. So we just kept moving more and more and more in the direction of getting into better known performers. And in the mid-70s, the rage in the vinyl business was direct-to-disc. Doug Sachs, Sheffield Records, and of course, Audiophile. And we were very focused in the serious quality area, and we thought, well, why don't we jump on the bandwagon, get into the direct-to-disc business, and that's how Telarc got started. I'm going to let my partner tell you how the name Telarc came about and how what our first Telarc record was. It was not the bass drum heard around the world, as many of you think.
It's the chords. Never step on microphone cables. There's another story to that that cost us $50,000.
Easy come, easy go.
I was spending time after I'd met Jack, going to a couple of other parts of the country. I was down in San Antonio, Texas. Ended up singing with San Antonio Opera and gigging wherever I could as a vocalist, and ended up managing a very famous old hi-fi store down there called Bill K. Sound. And in the process, was very aware of the direct-to-discs that Doug Sachs was making, and longed to do something like that with a really first-class orchestra. Notwithstanding that the challenge of getting 100 musicians together and creating 15-minute sides in a direct-to-disc fashion, which was completely much more of a challenge than anything that happened in the 78 days, where the times were half of that and the costs less than half. Came back to Cleveland, was living here. We had done a couple of well-thought-out vanity records, and again, as Jack mentioned, contacts. I had the opportunity at some point in time to work with Robert Shaw. I was a Tanglewood student. I got to know Seiji Ozawa. I had a musician connection with the Cleveland Orchestra. We had done those recordings that Jack mentioned with some of the members of the Cleveland Orchestra. We had a handful of calling cards. The whole world is built around the basis of having contacts and being able to use them to create what it is that you want to create. At what point in time we really knew that we wanted to create a commercial label, I don't think there was ever any definitive moment, except that we were watching Decca come over and record the Cleveland Orchestra, and they were kind enough to let us visit, and we listened to the music, and we loved the music, and I felt Jack, certainly from what I was hearing him do, could certainly do that, from a sonic point of view, could do that and even better. I guess I was an entrepreneur and didn't know it, and managed to go out and look for some contacts. We went to the management of the Cleveland Orchestra. The good news was that I had met Ken Haas when he was working down in Cincinnati in the early 1970s when I was down there for a short while, known as a singer, and went to him and had actually hatched the thought that perhaps with somebody else's financial backing, which turned out to be the Disc Washer Corporation, and maybe using the assistant conductor, because we didn't have any designs that we really could do much more than maybe find a way to hire them to do recording, a direct-to-disc recording. And when we met with Ken and asked him about it, he said, well, why wouldn't you want to record Lorne Mazel? Indeed, why wouldn't we want to record Lorne Mazel in the Cleveland Orchestra? I mean, that was as about as Rolls Royce as you could get next to the Vienna Philharmonic and a few other locations in those days. And I was around during the last years of Sells concerts, which were certainly remarkable, and that orchestra, believe me, when Mazel took it over, was playing unbelievably well. So they were certainly up to the task. So we took that challenge on. Lorne was fine, except he said, I'd like you to show me what this is all about. So we had to get together with a local company, which was then Cleveland Recording, to bring a lathe into Severance Hall and set up microphones and do a test so that Mazel could hear what we were talking about, which was a lot of trouble. I don't know if anybody's ever conceived what it's like to move a mastering lathe, but it's not a piece of cake. So we brought it in, did the test, and he liked it. So then we, that was September, I believe, of 76. We scheduled then for January of 77 to do this first direct-to-disc recording. Jack brought in another, well, he was a friend at the time, it maybe didn't turn out that way afterwards, but a mastering engineer from the West Coast and a mastering engineer from here, equipment as well, the disc washer people to bankroll it. And it was fine until we, you know, had this company that Jack had created called Advent Recording Corporation. And back in the early 70s, Advent Speaker Corporation in Massachusetts had made a record. And we were good friends. They knew us, we knew them. Occasionally they'd get an, you know, we'd get an order for their record that they did of some repertoire Bach somewhere in Massachusetts. And no problems. But right before we were about to do this recording with the Cleveland Orchestra, we get a cease and desist letter from the company that had just bought Advent, Sprague Electronics, saying, you don't have the right to use that name in conjunction with recording, and we thereby demand that you cease use of it. I went to DC, looked in the files, because we'd filed for copyright for it a number of years before. Turns out that 2 months prior, in the early 1970s, they had filed for use of that name. So we were, that was it. And we were coming down the 11th hour and had to have some kind of handle to put on the label name. We certainly didn't want to put a record out and have a lawsuit and have to pull it off the market, especially with somebody as prestigious as the Cleveland Orchestra. So one night late, after many attempts at hiring, we didn't have any money to go outside and find people to try to help us find names. I remember one of them that someone came up with was American Gramophone. I always remember that with great fondness. I was looking at a dictionary. It was a Latin dictionary, and just I was just thumbing, and came on T-E-L as a prefix, which comes from the Greek and has to do with something that means it's like a termination point, which is why it's used in transmission of a telephone. It goes something that goes from here to there. It also means the culmination point as well, like an end of. So we took the acronym Advent Recording Corporation and we ended it with T-E-L-A-R-C and created a little firebird story out of the name. You know, out of the ashes of the old name came Telarc. And we were soon to find out very shortly thereafter that Telefunken and Decca had merged to form a company called Teldec, which is where we actually went to do our first pressings over in Germany. So we created a little bit more confusion than we would have had if we'd have kept the original name, but that's where Telarc came from. The session was in the bloody winter of the 77-78 winter, which is, if anybody lived around this area knew that, you know, there was more snow and more cold than anybody could imagine. And to do it in January in itself, and we could barely get cars, you know, started and get cars on the, keep them on the road to get down there. Did the sessions. It was successful enough that it worked. There were technical problems about the recording that were disappointing, and we soon learned how much we didn't really want additional partners besides ourselves. We knew how to do what we did best, and that if we couldn't partner with some other people who were on the same page as us, that wasn't going to work. So without really any particular business plan, we simply loved what we loved. We were passionate about it. We had a lot of get up and go, moxie, guts. Nobody told us we couldn't, so why not? And the next phase then very quickly comes into play, and that is the being the first classical company to commercially release digital recordings. I'll let Jack speak to that issue.
Well, this is where some of the first self-effacing humor comes in. We did one more direct-to-disc and organ recording and realized that if we were going to be a big deal in the record business, or if we were even going to stay in business, it was not going to be through making direct-cut discs. I mean, it's fraught with problems, as many of you know. About that time, we were still making some vanity recordings, and they were being pressed by a company out in California. And the fellow who ran the parent company, a fellow mastering engineer named Steve Guy, who some of you may have remembered, called me one day and said, if you have not heard digital recording, you had better hear it. He had heard the demonstration of the SoundStream system. Tom Stockham had developed this wonderful system, which we knew nothing about, but we decided that how we would find out about it was that at that point, we had gotten ourselves to the point where Audio Technica was distributing what product we were doing at that time, because we continued to do some other things. And they were importing Japanese recordings that had been done digitally. So we ordered up a bunch of them and listened to them, and Bob and I said, there's something here that is really interesting, but it just doesn't sound quite right. Well, the system that they were using had a high frequency cutoff at about 16K. I mean, very, very limited. It was a 14-bit system, the Denon system. But we were invited to go to the October AES in the fall of 77 to hear a demonstration of Tom Stockham's SoundStream system. He had piggybacked on one of Bert White's direct-to-disc recordings with the Boston Pops and Fiedler. So we, along with our, at that time, financial backer, got ourselves to New York, listened to the demonstration, were much more impressed than we were with the Denon system, and we went to dinner with Tom and his wife and some other people, and we knew at the time that Tom was interested in getting his system into the mainstream record area. And he was going to do that by leasing it on a project-by-project basis because it was still in development. Well, Tom wanted to know what we thought. We had the gall to say, you know, it sounds really great, Tom, but you're gonna have to make it better. You're just going to have to get that high frequency. I mean, the high frequency response was rolled off it from 20Ks. We said, we have to have it above 22 or, you know, we're not going to do a project with you now. I mean, this is two guys from Cleveland who, we were sounding like real big shots. And Tom, in his own wonderful way, said, I'll do it. He called us that was in October. He called us in January, February. He said, I've got the system ready. Where's the project? So Bob and I were really on the spot. We spent a lot of time agonizing over what to do. We got together at my house one late snowy night in front of the fireplace and said, all right, we know we wanted to appeal to audiophiles. Do we want to do something with percussion, with brass, with organ? You know, it's got to be something really big and bombastic. And then we said, well, what have the audiophiles historically been most interested in? Mercury Living Presence. Frederick Fennell, Eastman Wind Ensemble. Do you know where Frederick is now? Yes, he's at the University of Miami. We got on the phone, said, how would you like to make the first digital recording with the entire wind, brass, and percussion section of the Cleveland Orchestra? And Fred said, how soon can I get there? You know, how quick can we do it? April 10, 11, 12, somewhere in that area of 1978, what became an historic recording. Stockham was there with his machine that had an upper frequency response of 22.5K. What he did was he upped the sampling rate to 50K. You know, he took it above the 44.1 that was the industry standard. And it was literally I mean, we had people there from audiophile magazines from all over, and I mean, everybody was just blown away, including us, who never expected it to sound as good as it did. From there, we went to Atlanta. Bob took his earlier connection with Shaw. Actually, somebody from Absolute Sound, who was on the board of trustees at the Atlanta Symphony, who happened to write for Absolute Sound, was at our Fennell session. So, you know, we had two entrees to Shaw, Bob's relationship with him and John Coolidge's ongoing relationship. John was a member of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra Chorus, still is. And that's when the Firebird got hatched. And that was actually the first commercial orchestral recording that was released that had used the digital system. From there, it just kept going. We didn't know it at the time, but when we did the first digital recording with Mazel, which was the pictures in an exhibition night on Ball Mountain, it later became the first commercially released recording of a world-class orchestra that was done digitally. We beat London Decca in their Vienna New Year's Eve concert by about 4 months. I mean, we had no idea, but it's a nice little asterisk on our curriculum vitae.
Bob's chomping at the bit to tell.
Huh. Well, there's a number of things.
Yeah, I mean, distribution and...
Yeah, I'm gonna go quickly back, the direct to this recording. You want to talk about pressure for the musicians. This is an orchestra that could play well. But the personnel manager at the time, David Zouder, who's still around, retired here in Cleveland, and was playing second trumpet. We put the opening of the Tchaikovsky Polonaise at the end of one of the sides, which has the trumpets coming in, ta 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 ta, in octaves. And the pressure was so great that during the breaks, he was out throwing up in the men's room. It was that much, you know, they were absolutely dead on. The amount of accuracy of their playing was not any less than it normally was. But they said, if we ever do another one of these with you again, it's double scale. For everybody, especially me. Starting with Tom, the industry standard hadn't been set yet to 44.1. We were hopeful that actually having pushed, you know, this system with SoundStream up to a 50K sampling rate would kind of set a standard that was better than what maybe people were talking about. But the industry ended up with this awkward number of 44.1. And digital was not called digital then. It was called PCM. The recordings that came out from Denon were called pulse code modulation PCM recordings. Telarc is the one who, by asking Tom Stockham, said, Tom, is there any reason why, you know, we can't call these digital recordings? Because, you know, digital watches were in at that time in the 70s. Everybody had digital watches, not analog, long gone now, except for some who can't let go. But which he said, no, of course not. So we had one logo that started out when we did the direct disc recordings, and then we changed this logo to say Telarc Digital, and borrowed the yellow color from Deutsche Grammophon because, you know, at the time it stuck out like a sore thumb wherever it showed up. And controversy, since I see Elaine Martone is with us today. Jack's wife is also here. Elaine has been with the company next to ourselves longer than anybody else. So if we say something that's completely incorrect, she should just stand up and correct us. She's been here with us since 1980. She, besides a secretary who we had, you know, we did it all ourselves. First records, we would pack them ourselves. We would put them in boxes. We put them in a Lincoln Continental that we bought for $400 and took them down to wherever Audio Technica is and outside of Akron, Fairlawn, Ohio, to deliver them to then be sold. And, you know, two guys did it all. We did our own accounting, we did whatever it was. That's how you run, you know, what was nothing but a small little one-room kind of business. But digital in a vinyl world was an interesting thing to have to go through, because our unspoken mission statement was obviously that of excellence in every aspect of what it was that we were doing, especially the sound, the performances, and so forth. And trying to make a good record, from the personal point of view, for me, was physically almost killed me. It was necessary to learn about the process in great detail in order to be able to have any sense of control over it. Because we learned quickly that the problems in terms of a good record started right at the very disc that you were cutting on. So when we were taking those wonderful digital masters and transferring them to vinyl in the mastering process to the lacquers, you had to do a lot of testing and searching. The manufacturer of the highest quality lacquers, which was a French firm called Paral, burned to the ground, and they did not rebuild the company. And we were then stuck with a couple of other manufacturers whose quality of the products were inferior. I actually got on found a mailing list for everybody who did mastering in the United States, sent them letters, said if you have any leftover Parals, I don't care if you've cut on one side, you've tested the disc, if you've got a blank side, we'll buy the discs. We got them, some had been sitting on top of somebody's, you know, pile of something, and they were covered with dust and filth. It didn't matter. We put them in, you know, we talked to Tom, we talked to some other scientific people who said, you know, what can we do with these? And it ended up that warm distilled water, Windex, and very many washed times, baby diapers were great for drying them. If you look at some of our early records of what's called the land, which is the space in between the grooves themselves, the grooves are pristine. The land looks like somebody, you know, scrubbed it with a Brillo pad, even though we were as gentle as we could, but it had nothing to do with, you know, what was under the substrate. Then there were going trips to Japan, getting special diamond styluses, cutting styluses made, so that the facets were perfect enough to really transfer the stuff. We get along to the 1812, trying to transfer the 1812 signal to a piece of vinyl, and the whole thing, that's what pushed us over the top and started to give us some money to get going. It was setting the bar so high for anybody who had a turntable to try to play that thing. And it absolutely was playable. The only problem is that when that first cannon shot came, the groove took a right turn at Albuquerque. And if most tone on, you know, most of the arms, the cartridges just became airborne because it hit that turn, and if they weren't designed really, really well, it just went off the disc. But it was we knew by having systems that were first class that if you had it right, you could play it. So we said, come on, jump. And the industry jumped. And it resulted in some good electronics equipment sales. And we never reached 1 million units of sale on that record, but we certainly did, you know, get up in the hundreds of thousands. So it was a very exciting time with doing that kind of thing. But we had help. There were some people who were mastering engineers, Stan Ricker, Bruce Leake, and others. And we even had to design a console where I was doing the cutting, the transfers to lacquers out in California and Irvine, where there were three extra buttons added to the console, which sent current to trick the cutter head into doing basically two things. One was digging deeper and to be able to force a fast spread, open up the space of the grooves before, you know, the big bass drum in the Firebird would come at the beginning of the infernal dance. Because without doing something like that, the echo factor was just horrible. You know, you'd hear that bass drum come 7 revolutions before it ever appeared. But again, that was if the lacquer material was too soft, you got all this echo. If the lacquer material was really good quality and it was solid, and you dug deep and you went wide, you could actually make it work. But Elaine's first job with the company was checking the metal matrix. We would be mastering out in California, shipping the lacquers to New York. New York would process the matrix because that's where there was a place that could do it best. She would listen to it in New York and say, no good. You know, or if we were lucky, good. I remember flying out, cutting for a couple of days, taking the red eye back, finding out that morning that they were no good, getting back on the plane and going back out. We cut the pictures at an exhibition, no, sorry, we cut the Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony 20 times, mastered it 20 times and did matrix on it 20 times before we got a set of parts good enough to make a record with. And then we had to send them to Europe, pray to God they didn't lose them, pray that they didn't screw them up over there. Spent nights doing telexes. If anybody remembers that, this was before facsimile became possible, and sure as hell before email. There were times when it got so desperate that I remember being with Jack at like 4 o'clock in the morning at the office when we'd come back from someplace and having all these problems and being on the phone to Germany saying, these are not good enough. And he's sitting there in his German accent saying, you guys can hear the Glasgow. So, you know, it was a tough thing. And nobody knew CD had been projected as a possible type of product. Tom Stockham was trying to develop a product which was a credit card shape. And it required a player that had four heads that spun around and read 90 degrees of material. And then, you know, each pass was 90 degrees with one of the heads, then the next head had to lock on, the next head had to lock on. Mechanically speaking, it was not something that was elegant enough of a design to really be practical. Maybe it would be in today's world with the advancements that have been made, but ultimately a round disc was a round disc, and that's what the world took. And we had 20 digital masters and 20 CDs in 1983 when Compact Disc launched. Sony at that time did not own a music company. Marita specifically said that he thought our products were the best recordings made out there, and he wanted an association. The very first high-end players that came out of Sony for the first year had a Telarc disc inside a box, and that launched us.
It also launched us in another direction. Not only did it launch us sort of away from strictly an audiophile company, but it launched us into our own distribution. And the reason for that was is that we were distributed still. We were primarily an audiophile company into the early 80s, but we had started to get in more and more into the mainstream. And I think probably the big break that put us in the mainstream, I think you would agree, would be that the Boston Symphony came to us and said, we are going to record the Beethoven Piano Concerto with Serkin and Ozawa, and we would like to do it with you. And we, after we picked ourselves up off the floor, we said, why not? Well, understand that Audio Technica at that time was the second largest manufacturer after Shure of phonograph cartridges in the world. And when we came out with the first CD in this country, the people in Japan at Audio Technica said to the American people, get rid of them.
They're a threat.
You know, they are a huge threat. And like within a period of days, Audio Technica US transferred all of their product, all of their inventory to us. They gave us their distributor and rep list. I mean, they were a perfect gentleman about making the changeover because they didn't want to do it. They wanted to hang in there. As irony would have it, Audio Technica in Japan finally saw the light and became one of the largest manufacturers of the laser reader that goes into CD players. So, but anyway, this gave us an opportunity to bring everything under our own roof, to develop our own distribution systems, and to start moving more and more into being a classical mainstream record label. And because of our earlier successes, we were able to attract more and more well-known organizations, conductors. And we also, back in the early 80s, decided that maybe jazz wouldn't be such a bad idea. We made one jazz recording in the early 80s with Mel Lewis and his big band, which was okay, but we just were not quite ready to get into that arena, because it takes a completely different approach, a different people selling the thing. You talk to different buyers and record stores. I mean, we were really learning the record business as we go, and we still are, for that matter. But things just kept moving on and developing and doing nicely. Unfortunately, one of the byproducts of our relationship with Sony and the development of the compact disc as we now know it is that the Soundstream company became less and less able to manage financially and finally just had to sell and close their doors. And we actually had bought one of the Soundstream recorders, which we still have and still works, and managed to use it for some time after our Sony relationship, but it just became more and more difficult to be putting our masters on that, to have to convert them, downsample them to 44.1 through a very crude sampling frequency converter, crude by today's standards. By then, that was the only one in the world. But we just gradually, more and more, kept molding ourselves as a mainstream classical label. And in the mid-80s, we started moving over into Europe to do recordings. We started working with a
I won't say retired, but somebody who was London Decca's head classical producer, James Mallinson, who decided to go freelance, and he started to open some doors for us into some of the European orchestras, to some of the conductors, people like Andre Previn, Charles McCarris, Vienna Philharmonic, Berlin Philharmonic, that sort of thing, which was pretty big stuff for these two guys from Cleveland. And we actually had planning sessions where we tried to put together what our catalog would look like over a period of the next 3, 5, 7, 8 years, and then went about trying to, in most cases, being successful at attracting the performers and the conductors that we could do that with. We started working with Previn and the Royal Philharmonic in 1985. And at the very first session, we said, how'd you like to do some jazz? Nah, never doing jazz again. That's history. That's part of my other life. Never. Well, a very interesting other thing happened on that very first session. Tony Faulkner, whose name may be known to a number of you, who is a very fine freelance engineer in London, has his fingers in all the latest stuff and is connected with all the right people, came to me. We hired Tony to provide equipment and engineering backup for our first sessions in London. And he said, I've got a friend who's in town. He's got some cable he would like you to check out. I said, fine. I'm of the opinion that, these high-performance cables, I think somebody in High Fidelity magazine summed it up well. It's a disease, or it's a cure for which there is no disease. Noel Lee at Monster Cable had been bugging the life out of us to try some, and I said, well, maybe. Anyway, Tony brought this fellow in, and he said, this is A.J. Vandenhall. Now, for those of you who are really hardcore record files, A.J. Vandenhall has made and modified some of the finest phonograph cartridges ever sold. And he had this oxygen-free cable, hard, solid core, liquid crystal, oxygen-free, the acronym is about as long as your arm, and said, I'd like you to try this. So, fine. When you recorded then in England, it was what we call rehearse record. To do a normal LP, you would have 4 3-hour recording sessions. In this country, if we can get 2 3s, we are feeling very, very fortunate. So with that kind of circumstance, you got time to play. So we had what we believed were a matched pair of B&K 4006 microphones, which we put side by side on the winds. We put Vandenhall cable on one, and we put Tony's garden variety Belden cable on the other. And while Previn was rehearsing, we were doing what? Tchaikovsky 5. While he was rehearsing, we had a chance to just sort of play around. So we listened to the mic with the Belden cable for a while. And then we said, okay, let's listen to the other one. Let's humor him. We opened the fader on the Vandenhall cable, and everybody in the room said, what happened? It was just like somebody took Windex and cleaned a dirty glass. The difference was that dramatic, and believe me, I became a believer right on the spot. Got back to Cleveland and called Monster Cable and said, all right, make some mic cables and send them out. We'll try them. And it was just one of those aha experiences that you have during your life that you're not ready for it. But that kind of thing is certainly, it's all part of the package that makes Telarc the Telarc sound what it is. And we wouldn't dare go out and just put up garden variety Belden cable on our microphones now, because we know there is a difference. So things went along pretty well. The compact disc sort of saved the industry in the early 80s from near disaster, and you know, it gave everybody an opportunity to re-record all of the standard stuff. Well, that that was all well and good then, but I'll let Bob tell you what happened after that.
Give you all the tough stuff.
The fun stuff. Yep. Yeah. Something should be said about the business side of this company. One, it's not a hobby, and it never has been. We ran it and formed it as a business, and we never looked at it from that point of view. We are not, in my opinion, audiophiles. That doesn't mean that we don't respect what audiophiles are into, and that doesn't mean that we don't, and our staff now, we have 54 direct employees of the company. We have relationships throughout the world for distribution, some with major labels, some with independent companies. Jack has now trained a ongoing staff of engineers in the artisan work that he knew how to do and knows how to do, still does, all the time. But to have gone from releasing a handful of records a year to having a schedule now of 60-some releases on average, even though a handful of those may be compilations from time to time. But the record industry in the glory days and the rise on the bell curve came to an end in 1991. And since then, the industry has been in decline. Since then, the industry has been in turmoil. All kinds of things that the industry could point out that are problems these days are only part of a very big picture. I understand there was a conference about downloading. If you were to get a major label up here, they would tell you that's the biggest crisis they've got. That's really not true. The biggest crisis they have is learning how to create a new business in a new business world because old business models don't continue to work. Guess there was some interesting discussion.
No fist fights, though.
But you won't get us arguing about that. I think, if anything, everybody in the industry ought to be happy that everybody got into downloading because they got them hooked on the process. And now that they're hooked on the process, and the good sense of regulation and fair play here is going to be in place, and that, you know, I think this will become a very viable, worthwhile part of business that goes on. You sit and try to fix something that's broken that doesn't have the ability to be fixed, that you're just wasting your time and spinning your wheels. And Telarc has had the advantage historically of being able to move very quickly. We're also small, so we are not the front of the dog, we're at the tail. And so the industry goes, so do we from time to time. And it's been a huge challenge. It's been a huge challenge financially. We make changes. We have diversified the portfolio of products that we do. Not only, you know, occasionally with some fear and trepidation. Classical is probably about 20% of what we do now. 20% is probably traditional jazz. 20% maybe blues. I mean, it's just rough ballpark numbers. We have another label we acquired which does other areas of music that we don't. Crossover projects, unusual things. We did Liza Minnelli's, thinking, since she was in the news yesterday and talking about her Betty Ford days, we recorded her straight out of the Betty Ford Clinic in her Live at Carnegie Hall show in 1988, I believe it was, Elaine? 87, sorry. 87. Which was probably the best record she ever made. And we did that without a safety net. We recorded it live to two tracks. We had a four-track recorder running, but we never used it, at least not for the production. And she had only one comment about one edit in a two-disc set, which was pretty remarkable. And that speaks to the depth of excellence that lives within our company, within pretty much everybody who works there. It's an unspoken requirement. It's also pretty much unspoken that you better be self-motivated or you're in the wrong place. There is no money to waste. When we enjoyed our great experiences with the Cleveland Orchestra, but when the price of doing business at the cost that it was no longer practical, we stopped. And we stopped way before the majors stopped. The majors went for years losing tons of money in their classical divisions without any fiscal responsibility, in my opinion, being held. If people are aware of it, they let it go because of reasons that I can't know. We're not part of other companies. But we could feel it immediately, and we were in the midst of finishing some projects with Previn in Vienna, when we had to stop because we knew we were about to lose $100,000 on something, and for a company of our size, that wasn't possible. Occasionally, it put us in some tough positions. We are our word, and when we say we're going to do a project with somebody, we do. But we also didn't feel we could kill the company by continuing to do something that wasn't going to serve us well. So we struggled through the 90s, and recently, as it was 5 years ago, last May, another call came in from our friends at Sony, from a fellow named David Kawakami. We had some pre-knowledge of what this was all to be about, but we hadn't been asked to participate, and this had to do with the DSD recording process, Direct Stream Digital, which, if you're not familiar with that technology, is a single-bit digital system. It is not pulse code modulation. It operates at a bandwidth for us from zero, direct current, all the way up to over 100,000 hertz. It's like being given a canvas to paint on, which is like that compared to something like this. Still never seems like enough, though. We can always find more dynamic range than we can put. But we have been working with that now for the last 6 years, almost, and have the second largest catalog of Super Audio CDs. We are now doing everything in multi-channel recording, and any major projects are being released in hybrid form. We pushed the hybrid issue very, very hard. Sony, which developed the product and developed the technology to have a hybrid disc, did not want to support it because they didn't see the financial wherewithal. We persisted. We have butted heads with Sony many, many times, but it's always been in a way that they found was tolerable and respectful from both sides. So fortunately, that has won out, and I suspect that we look forward. I'm going this far this fast only because I know we've got to give David his half hour here, and we just got a couple minutes left. And we'd also, for us, there's a very big distinction between home theater surround and surround sound audio, which I don't even like to use that terminology. Most of the time, I like to refer to it as three-dimensional audio. And for us, it is a world we're living in now and perfecting again and again and again, and with a staff that has put in more time and hours in the beta world than anybody should have a right to do. But they do it because they so love what we're doing and how it sounds and how it serves music in a way which is so positive that the commitment is absolute. We'll see SACD players in cars by 2005, 2 years of that, and the additional equipment that's coming and the more affordable equipment that's coming for the reproduction of three-dimensional or multi-channel audio. We believe that this is a product that will definitely have its substance. It already has a market for us, which we find to be very much worthwhile. And yes, it gives us an opportunity in some instances to continue to record. We're fortunate in Atlanta and Cincinnati, where we have had such long-term relationships, that we have two brand new music directors who are phenomenal musicians and who are doing just wonderful things with their orchestras and with their music. So that's what it's all about. And so here, all these years later, we're still alive and well and on the bleeding cutting edge of technology. I'll let you post-scraper ask and see if there's any burning questions.
Well, it may be obvious, but you know, one of the things I wrote down on my notes is why have we have not been successful just on the basis of our great sound. I mean, a lot of people out there know how to make great sound, but it is the dedication, as Bob said, of the people we have working for us. We have almost everybody who works in the production department, in the side of Telarc that has to do with creating the finished product. These people have some sort of music in their background. They're either graduates, performance graduates, performers, teachers. That makes such a huge difference. I mean, these people know. I mean, that, I think that's why I was able to go out and learn how to make a decent sound, because I was a band director and a choir director for years. I know what it sounds like from the podium, or at least what, you know, you'd hope it would sound like. The other thing is that the artists that we work with, to a person, feel that they are getting honest, straightforward treatment from Telarc. We pay their royalties on time. We don't mess around with them. You know, we don't do screwy things like some of the major record companies have done. We are straightforward and honest, and they really appreciate that. Now, we've got just a few minutes left for questions. Yes? Yes. It was so short-lived because it was nothing more than just first of all, we couldn't get it to work right on any session that we ever had it on. We actually had it on the Liza Minnelli Carnegie Hall, and we couldn't use any of it. It was a kind of a reworking of, what was that video system?
I don't remember.
An F1. Yeah. It just wasn't reliable.
It never worked, and to the best of our knowledge, it was really smoke and mirrors.
Right.
Sorry to say. And I don't think Brad knew that.
Yeah. Is David Lewis here?
Yeah.
All right. I have got to answer your question. An email was sent out soliciting questions to the membership. You're the only person who responded. He wants to know how we can do such great sounding recordings in Music Hall in Cincinnati when some of the early things done there were very boomy. As one of my colleagues in music school used to say, years of practice and self-denial and experience and know-how. It's just knowing how to strike a fine balance between direct sound and reverberant sound.
Well, I'd add to that that why Jack is such a great engineer and why that tradition is passed on is because it's done in a way that can actually be taught. It's a way that people can be trained to use it if you've got the ears. I mean, if you don't have the talent of the ears, it won't matter. But it's having tools and knowing how you use those tools. The angle of a microphone when you're using a minimal mic approach, just a few degrees can make a huge difference. Weather changes everything for us. We can have a setup that's in place, nothing changed in that hall. We come back the next day, the barometric pressure's changed, the humidity's changed, we have to move the microphones. You might move them a couple feet. You have to be able to constantly be able to translate what you're hearing into the application of the tools that you've got and what you have learned about them. And that came from all those years that he was out in some of the worst recording venues on earth learning how to make them sound good. So, you know, it's that kind of a practice, and experience. All of this is experiential, especially, you know, multi-channel, three-dimensional audio will never be something that anybody will get into unless they have the experience. You can't talk about it. I can say it's great, and you say, okay, he says it's great. But until you experience it, it means nothing.
Clear in the back. I've got a very short answer for that, and it's something Lauren Mazel said to me once. He said, you know what I like about your recordings? It's that what I hear on your recording is what I hope the audience is hearing behind me. Now, I can say we try to recreate the best seat in the house, and the minute you say that, 50 people will say, okay, well, what is the best seat in the house? But it's to try to strike a fine balance between direct sound, what James Mallinson calls a tactile feel, and the reverberant field itself. We have time for what, about two more?
Well, you've been persistent.
Two questions. One is, what's been the evolution of the editing process for the DSP recording? Perhaps another issue is, which workstation are you using to make one? And second, there are rumors that Sony is modifying the DSP process for increased resolution. Are you part of those sets of experiments?
Any modifications that are being done are being incorporated immediately. We had three Sonoma Systems, which was the company that Sony bankrolled to create this product. Sadie, now we've had Sadie Blue, which is the new DSD editor in-house. It's still very much beta. We have only 8 tracks that we can do unless we slave things together, which is a hellishly difficult process. So as a largely multi-channel tool for pop music, it's still a ways away, which is one of the reasons it hasn't been embraced completely, I mean, or more quickly, I should say. I missed the other part of the question. I didn't answer
the
something.
The increased resolution, I think that's already happened.
Well, it continues to happen. What we understand about DSD technology, which is so wonderful, is that all the advances that get made to that technology, the way it's designed, you will never obsolete something that's been previously created. It will continue to be adaptable without any kind of difficulty or problems, and that has so far been our experience. And I can't really, you know, get into the technical side of that to the degree that you may like. Sorry. Well, you had one.
We're told 2 more questions. We'll be around
nice,
after
a nice gentleman with the, you're next.
And I'm just wondering if you can elaborate upon that a little bit.
Glut in the marketplace. Too much product. Everybody finally builds a library. You can only listen to so many CDs. You get a nice library of compact discs in your at home, and you can go back and listen to things periodically with not too much trouble. So what's the motivation to buy something new? Musical tastes change. You look at the concert business. You look at what orchestras' challenges are in terms of bringing audiences in. It's happening globally throughout the world. Add computers, add other toys that people are spending their time on, add the ton of budget product that got thrown out in the marketplace. I mean, the marketplace cannot handle that kind of quantity. It can on the basis of it being accessed through the internet. It can't do it in a retail store location.
I'm lucky enough to have gotten the microphone, so thank you.
Sorry.
This is a technical question related to equipment, and so perhaps it should go to Jack. But microphones, you mentioned cables. I'm curious about microphones you're using and any insights you can give us there. Also, other equipment, particularly what you use to monitor your speakers. At AES, Jack Ludwig talked about the fact that for surround sound, he insists on using headphones. And I'm wondering if you feel the same way and whether what sort of headphones you might be using.
Boy, are you going to be disappointed. I get asked, thank you for not asking what sound systems or playback systems we have in our homes. My wife is collapsing. We have pretty much standardized over the years on the Shep's line of microphones. They're quiet, they are very accurate, they're nearly without color, although I must say I prefer B&K, now Danish Pro Audio, DPA, for piano work. We've recently come into possession of some of the new Sennheiser MKH-800s, which have an upper frequency response of beyond 40K, which you got to be careful how you use them, but they are very, very useful. We are currently trying to standardize on a speaker. The problem with monitor speakers is that it's one thing to get Bob and me to agree on what speakers we're going to carry out in the field. I mean, early on, I helped ADS develop some of their speaker line, and that's what we used. Now we've got a number of editors and engineers, and we've got probably about 10 people that have to agree on a speaker. And boy, it ain't easy, believe me. We are currently, our mainline speaker now is the ATC line, the British line, which we're finding quite a bit of agreement on among the people that have to do critical listening on them. We happen to feel that the best electronics out there that you can put in front of your microphones is the Millennia line. We do have a console that's been highly hot-rodded by a fellow on the West Coast. It was originally made by Ramza, but it doesn't resemble internally anything that Ramza ever did. But I would say Shep's microphones, Shep's, Sennheiser, and B&K's both MIT and Monster Cable, and recently we've got a couple other come into the picture, Ed Meitner, who makes some great digital processors, and Bell have started to find their way onto our sessions. Amps, the ATCs are internally amped, but we have quite a collection of Bryson amps, Threshold amps, and Krell amps, all of which match up in one way or another with the various speakers that we have.
That question could keep going on, and what one might have for home use and what we use for professional tools can be totally different.
Right. Who has the mic?
I'll make it real quick. Are you planning an SACD transfer of the first Fennell digital?
Yes.
Thank you.
It's coming very soon.
To a store near you.
To a website near you.
Thank you. Jim Powell here. I was spoiled in the early days with quadraphonic sound, discrete and various the variations. I'm impressed with some of the issues that I'm getting nowadays off the record shelves in the stores. Done regular music on 5.1 Dolby and in DTS. You commented about three-dimensional. Would you like to put on your pointed hat and think out what you think might be the future for this particular kind of method of recording or method of presenting to the customer?
Not Dolby or DTS.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't have anything against them. They're perfectly fine. I think they're especially fine for home theater and for movies. But, you know, the DSD technology, we are totally and completely, not because of Sony or any other reason, in favor of it because it's the best. I mean, anything, especially too, that's pulse code PCM based, can't come close to what DSD can do. DSD is the analog of digital recording, in our opinion.
I keep reading that record stores are on the way out. Big chains are dying. Little record stores are dying everywhere. Do you see that happening? And if it is happening, what will you do?
Well, sure. We've had our butts kicked by what's going on in the industry, you know, with bankruptcies and closed stores and the rest of it. But retail won't go away. Retail will continue to happen. You have to watch what's going on around the country in certain locations, Massachusetts, Newbury Comics, unusual people who are learning how to retail in specialized ways. There are always going to be some excellent retailers out there. But the experience, you know, for the consumer will ultimately drive whether that works or doesn't work. Again, it can't, you know, there's between 35,000 and 40,000 new releases a year. The average record store can only hold about 35 SKUs, period. And that's talking about keeping depth of catalog, keeping, you know, Beatles releases, and keeping multiple copies of releases. So there's no way on earth that you could possibly hold a dearth of a product in any location at retail. What we look at, downloading, Amazon for us is like a brick and mortar store. Amazon, you place the order over the internet, but it comes from a warehouse location. It's just an extension of brick and mortar. Downloading is different to some degree, but it's not that different. There is a place where there exists the product in a database of digital technology that you can go online and you can take that from their location and you can bring it to your home. You do it by downloading, and hopefully you're paying for it. And we have our own website for our products. We don't undercut our retail relationships. But that's where the creativity comes from. And artists, more and more and more, we encourage them. We want artists who are out there performing. When they perform, they sell product after the shows. That's how I used to buy my records in the 1960s. I went to a concert, and you know, when I came out, there was the table, and there were the records, and I always bought something, unless the group was really terrible. Last one. Well, I mean, we could upsample it to DSD, and in some instances have, but we have Sony and Terre Haute, Digital Audio Disc Corp, has a massive digital library, which is also redundantly backed up elsewhere, where pretty much every recording we've ever made is archived. So we have our own master tapes, which are in storage at our warehouse. We have, you know, the archives in two different locations there with them, and very high quality resolution, you know, and and safe storage methods. And we are, you know, eventually we may upsample. It depends on the band. We don't want to do what the industry is doing necessarily, which is to take things that are weak sellers and throw them out for no good reason. But if it's a downloading issue and somebody wants it, then maybe that's where those will live. Don't know.
David, you're about to be on. We'll be around if for those of you who did not get your questions answered.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.